Bell hadn't rung yet, so I just closed
it. There it is.
There it is.
Well done.
There it is. Well, good morning. Glad to have all you with us. And, this is the third to last lesson of Matthew. It's gone pretty quick. So, today we're going to look at really the last week of Jesus' earthly life, or our earthly ministry, because actually he does come back for a little bit to the disciples after the crucifixion. But it's a very important event in the world history. In fact, it's probably the most important event in the history of the world, the crucifixion of Jesus. But it was time for him to complete his earthly ministry, and to do so, he had to return to Jerusalem, which was he knew what was waiting for him. He was warned not to do it, but he had to do it anyway. More than one third of Matthew's gospel is dedicated to the final week of Jesus' life. Of the 1,087 words, I think it's about 300 and something words are dedicated to the final week. So this shows you that it's a very important day, time in the life of Scriptures, the life of Christ and His ministry. And really, we're going to look at, in these chapters, it's a trial of Judaism. And if you notice, his language gets more direct, gets more sharp, and he pretty much convicts those of Judaism of not following God's law, of doing their own will. And the schooling for the disciples is over. It's time for them to step up and take their place into the community of God and to go forth and teach what he has taught them. So, it's, like I say, it's a very important time in the life of Christ, the life of disciples. It's a very important time for the life of us in our service to God. We're going to look at I don't know if this is as accurate as it can be, but there's a likely scenario for the first 3 days, what we're going to look at. Sunday, it looks like between Matthew 1 through 17. That's the first day he goes in. Monday, you've got two verses, 18 and 19 and 21. And then Tuesday, we have Matthew 21, 22, 25, 46. So, covers a pretty good bit. The Tuesday covers a pretty good bit of territory. So, they go into Jerusalem. Bethpage is where they went and got the donkey. He comes in through the Garden of Gethsemane, Kidron Valley, and goes into the temple and observes. Does a little more than observing. We'll look at that a little bit later. And Bethpage means house of unripe fig. I thought that was interesting. I don't know that it has any significance to the story, but that's what it means. This is another view of it geographically. You can see where Jerusalem is, and Bethpage, and Bethany, and Jericho. So all this happened in this last week in this area right here. So. All right, the trial point for entry. Marty, would you read the first 17 verses there, or first 11 verses of 21?
21.
Yeah.
And when they drew nigh to Jerusalem, and came to Bethphage, unto the Mount of Olives, then Jesus sent two disciples, saying to them, Go into the village that is over against you, and straightway you shall find an ass tied, and a colt with her. Loose them, and bring them unto me. And if anyone say aught unto you, you shall say, The Lord hath need of them, and straightway he will send them. Now this has come to pass, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken through the prophet, saying, Tell you, the daughter of Zion, Behold, thy king cometh unto thee, meek and riding upon an ass, upon a colt, the foal of an ass. And the disciples went and did even as Jesus appointed them, and brought the ass and the colt, and put on them their garments, and he sat thereon. And the most part of the multitude spread their garments in the way, and others cut branches from the trees and spread them in the way. And the multitudes that went before him and that followed cried, saying, Hosanna to the Son of David, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord, Hosanna in the highest. And when he was coming to Jerusalem, all the city was stirred, saying, Who is this? And the multitude said, This is the prophet Jesus from Nazareth of Galilee.
I'm glad to see you reading the American Standard. That's what I have up here. Okay, so this is the story of the triumphal entrance. It's, like I say, a very important part of the Bible, of Matthew. It, like I say, it's one of the most remarkable earthly times in the life of Christ. It's found in all four Gospels, so it shows you it's important. And up to this point, Jesus often told people not to do what he had done, tell what he had done. Do you remember the miracles, what he would tell the people? Don't tell what I've done. Don't spread this. Of course, they go and spread it, and then he had to go to the wilderness, things like that. He wanted to keep that anonymity. So what had changed from the time where he would heal somebody and tell them not to let anybody know what he'd done until now? It looks like something has changed in the way he is reacting. So what do you think is what has changed?
This timeline, for one thing, it's close at hand. You know, the hour is up on him, so it makes sense that he would start revealing those things, because when his time does come, it's not like it's back when he first started.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Okay, that does make sense. I think that's a lot of it. It was, he wanted to be noticed. In other words, he wanted all eyes on him. He wanted the Jewish leaders to know he was coming into town. This is where his 3 years of ministry was the pinnacle of it. And that's what he's pointing to.
There was a kind of rhythm. John's account is chronological, where tabernacles, he came a little late, but you know, and then dedication, that's December, tabernacles September, then December, mm-hmm. Now 3.5 months later. So he's coming every, you know, 2 or 3 months, but then leaving.
Right.
Right. And somewhere in there, the healing, raising of Lazarus is in there too. So there are these trips that almost like stir up something, you know.
But it wasn't his time, so he would
right,
leave.
Right, it would be a month or two, then he'd be right. Back again. Of course, right. the raising of Lazarus was still on their minds, and their plan to kill both him and Lazarus is what John says.
Yeah, very good. By the way, this is the only time in Matthew that a prophecy was told before it was enacted, or came to fruition. He tells it, and then it didn't happen. Usually it happened, and then Matthew brings it up. Okay, very good. Another reason was in verse 4, it says, Now it has come to pass that it might be fulfilled which was spoken through the prophet, saying. So this was something that was prophesied back, way back in the Old Testament, and it was coming to fruition. All things were being fulfilled. And like I said, everybody's eye was, Jesus wanted every eye on him to show that he was in there. Okay. How did the arrangement for obtaining the donkey prove his divine knowledge? This is one of the questions that Sewell asked. How did it prove that he had divine knowledge? Was this a normal, everyday thing?
One thing, he knew where the donkey would be, and secondly, he knew that they would be challenged if yep. they loosed the donkey. But he also knew that if they drove the source of it, that they would be allowed to carry the donkey along.
Yeah, that's remarkable, isn't it? He knew where the donkey was. He knew that if he just said, the Lord needs it. I said, well, oh, okay, he needs it, so let's go. Somebody said it's sort of like a spy movie. There was a mission, and there was a password or a code word, and then they got to go, but that's maybe.
You wonder if there was some previous arrangement, but we don't know that.
You're not told, are we?
Whoever owned the donkey and challenged their disciples, very popular knew who they were.
Right, I think the pre-arrangement proves his intentionality. He had the whole event, the week, probably planned out. You know, even whether miraculously or not, he knew when to be in the temple and when he would be challenged. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, all these events were kind of a cascading series of, you know, of events that would lead up to his arrest.
Yeah, they sort of built on each other, didn't they? Yeah. We're going to look at that with the three parables. I think they build on each other. Did the use of the donkey send them any other messages to the people, to Romans, to what were the kings of Israel not supposed to have?
Horses.
Yeah.
Horses.
So this king comes in on donkey. So he's not on a war horse. He's not likely to draw attention from the Romans. And it pretty much shows how lowly he was in riding a donkey. You don't see many warriors, many people that's going to overthrow Pontius Pilate and the Roman Empire coming in riding a donkey. probably got the attention of everybody else too. It also showed that, you know, absent the horse, so that they were a peculiar people. As we said, the kings were not supposed to have the horses. Some trust in chariots, some in horses, but we remember the name of the Lord our God, Psalms 27. So,
another thing, pretty well correct, but if he riding on that donkey that had not been trained, it was moving along. So that was a miracle within itself.
It really is, because breaking an animal or like that to ride, let somebody ride on the back. Yeah, you're right. You're right.
He wasn't a rodeo man.
No, but it did. He wasn't riding a war horse. He was riding a beast of burden, and it showed his lowliness. Well, Sewell asked this question: do you think you could have he could have rallied a revolt against the Romans at this point? This had been established, or could he have rallied the people at this point?
This is the common way of doing it. You see it over and over in the stories of the kings, how someone decides to usurp the existing king, like David's son.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you gather up some people and you come in and they make a big announcement and they kind of parade in, and you know, the assumption is that they're just taking over.
Yeah.
So this would have been the perfect time if that was his
plan. If that was his plan. Yeah. I think he probably could have got people on his side and maybe willing to die for a cause, but that wasn't his plan. And as I said, the donkey showed, I think it showed the Romans too, really. They didn't have to take him seriously because he was coming in riding in on a donkey. He wasn't a threat to them. So, but nonetheless, he did have that entrance. He rode in on the donkey. Everybody knew he was there, and so he was setting the stage for the coming events in this week. Okay, cleansing the temple. What divine qualities do we see reflected in Jesus' reactions in cleansing the temple?
Holiness.
Holy. Who was he upset for?
God.
For God, yeah. He wasn't upset because of anything that was against him, but it was God. And
it seems to me that Jesus, during his lifetime, reflected every quality of God in one way or another. On the Mount of Transfiguration, that's the one time you see the glory of God reflected in Jesus. And this is a case where the wrath of God is demonstrated.
Right.
And without this and the cursing of the fig tree, you wouldn't have much of an evidence of God's wrath in Jesus.
That's true. Well, we'll see. Christ does visibly show anger in this week, and several instances. In fact, there in this final week, there are several times that he showed visible anguish, anger.
The question that it caused to be raised was by what authority?
Yeah.
So there's some degree of power or authority or religious ownership or something like that that is demonstrated.
Yeah, that's true. So can we contrast the conduct of his anger right now with that of the cross? What was the difference in the demeanor of Jesus at that point? Here he's angry, just turning over tables, money going everywhere, because they pretty much changed the temple of God into a flea market. And he was not upset. But at the cross, he didn't revile when he was reviled. He kept his mouth closed. He let it happen. And the question is, what was the difference? And I think the difference is that he was upset for God and what they had done to the temple of God, disregarded God's divinity, power, and at the crucifixion, it was his time. It's what he came to earth to do, is to die on the cross, and he wasn't going to do anything to prevent that. So, any comments on that question? Okay. Now, the next thing, the fig tree. It's always puzzled me why this was in there. Has it puzzled anybody else? What did it represent? Why is it there? At the entrance, and then the next day comes and sees the fig tree, and there's no figs on it.
I had read that it's condemning the Jews. He's going to spend this week putting them on trial, condemning them. They did not bear fruit worthy of Christ. Just like fig tree, it's an object lesson for his disciples.
Yeah, I finally read the same thing. So that makes sense to me too. It's still pointed out in the lesson, fig trees, the fruit comes on before the leaves or at the same time. And so this fig tree was fully leaved out, should have had fruit on it, but it didn't. And if you take the analogy that it represented the Jewish nation, it was fully leaved, but they weren't producing any fruit that God wanted them to produce. It's the best example or explanation I've come across on it. Are there others that people, any of you heard? I think it's this is just the first demonstration of what's coming against Judaism.
Okay.
Yeah.
We certainly see in other places where, you know, those that do not bear fruit, they are tossed into the fire.
Mm-hmm.
That they are judged as not being of a sufficient value or of any value. And, you know, cursed in their existence.
So. Yeah. So, yeah, and it says that I think Matthew says it withered at once, but it really wasn't at once. It was the next day that they came back by and saw it withered. I think it meant it did immediately. It's what started dying immediately when Jesus cursed it. So, yeah, so that's why. Did you read Whiteside? Anyway. The Jewish nation, they just had not done what they were supposed to do. Okay, so we're going to look at the three parables of judgment. So I'm going to ask y'all to do a class thing. If Sewell and Sarah and you four do the first one there, you the rest of them back row, and you can y'all can do the second one, and Marty and Mike, if you'll do the third one, just take a few minutes to look at it. Those are just some questions I put up there. You don't have to look at it. I'm really looking at what's the parable mean, and what does it mean for us, or can we get anything out of it? So it's parable of two sons, 21 through 28 through 32, parable of vineyard, 21 33 46, you both back there, and then Marty and Mike, 22 1 through 14, the parable of the wedding beast. Okay, let's go ahead and we just, it's a good discussion, it sounds like, about this one, but let's stop it when you get some. We got a lot of stuff to cover, and I'm probably not going to get to all of it anyway. So the first group there, what is the parable, and what did you come up with?
Wait, Carl. Okay. Well, the answer is in verse 32, the two sons, the first son who refused to obey but then later did, is the tax collectors and the harlots who didn't even pretend to be religious or the thought of God, but when John the Baptist and Jesus came, they listened to them and followed their teaching. But the Jews, the leaders who claimed to be doing the will of God and said they were following God, rejected them both.
Yeah.
So even though they said we will go, they didn't go.
That's right. Okay. I think he's pretty much just identifying the groups in this parable. Is there what's the point of the whole thing?
Are you really following God and doing what He says, or are you just talking about? Are you just saying you are?
I think that's it. And that's the lesson for us. Do we follow what God says, or are we just talking about it? And so I think he's identified Israel, and he's identified the Gentiles in this parable. Okay, the next one. What do we got on that one?
The characters, you've got four groups. You've got your landowner. You've got your God, who's provided all that is necessary and needed. And you've got these vine growers or tenants, renters who have been given custody and responsibility for it. You've got the slaves or servants of the landowner. It might include people like prophets, based on the way they're treated, you know, who are doing the will of the landowner,
mm-hmm.
and who are mistreated and not given what is due them.
Mm-hmm.
And then the landowner eventually even says he'll send his son. He'll respect him. And in condemning themselves, not only do they not respect him, but they try to seize that inheritance for themselves.
Yeah.
They kill him.
They're doing exactly what Jesus was sent there to do. And it's a story of God and the prophets, and Jesus coming to earth, and they're telling them what they're going to do. And it's a condemnation of themselves. go ahead, Sewell.
I think that verse 43 is really an important verse. And they said he's going to take it away from you and give it to a nation to bear fruit.
Mm-hmm.
And so many people today think the Jews have some special place with God in God's plan. But I think that very clearly said it's taken away, the promises are taken away from you and given to another, which is a spiritual nature, mm-hmm. nation, of which the Jews could be right a part if they wanted, as Paul pointed out, but it's still it's not Jews, physically Jews. It's this new nation, the kingdom of heaven.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think this builds on the last one. We identified the two groups. I think this extends the by showing that the Jewish leadership had gone beyond the passive disobedience. They were actually to malice, where they were killing people and eventually would kill the Son of God in the parable. Very good. Okay, Marty, Mike, what y'all get on the last one?
So the characters are a little bit more intensified. There's a king with authority, obviously, to condemn people. And he has a wedding feast for his son. There are kind of four movements. The first is just a general invitation, which was more or less ignored, kind of a passive, negative response to come to the wedding feast. Second movement is a more intense invitation, where he kind of even says what's on the menu, right? Says, here's the food, and he sends another set of servants, and is actively rejected with not only excuses, but also violence to the servants who are sent out to invite people. The third movement is more open invitation, where the servants are just supposed to gather anyone, good and bad, who will come, which they do, and that fills the house. Okay. That's the third movement. Obviously, kind of suggesting, again, the rejection of those who might have been chosen first and had opportunity, who, you know, violently rejected. But in the third movement, then everybody's welcome to come. And then the fourth movement is one of those guests did not dress properly and didn't have the wedding garment on, which was apparently an insult. And so the king casts him out to outer darkness and punishes him. What's interesting is that those four movements are about choices people made.
Right.
But the last verse says, many are called, but few are chosen. So it's kind of like, the suggestion is God's chosen, but if you look at the stories, every one is about the people themselves making the choices, either to ignore, to reject actively, right, to come, and to come unprepared. Right. So those are all choices people make.
Yeah. I think that last one, without the wedding garment, is a warning to us. I mean, he did come in out of the fields, but he was expected to do something, clean up, put fresh clothes on or something, but I think that's pointing to us. And I think, if you remember in the second parable, the question was, what will the landowner do? Well, I think this is what he will do in this parable.
In this case, it's a king.
Yeah.
Not his father, not just a landowner, but a king with authority.
Yeah.
Which, even if he didn't really care to go to the wedding feast, you should go.
You should go anyway.
Right.
Yeah. So, very good.
It's like he gave him choices.
Yeah. So
there's another thing in this parable that goes beyond what you would expect. Verse 7, when he heard about his fury, he sent out his armies, destroyed the murderers, and burned up their city, which is more than you expect. Fellas didn't come to a wedding.
Yeah.
And I think it goes on, it's describing what's going to happen to the Jews.
Yeah.
And particularly burning up their city refers to destruction of Jerusalem, which was.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, and it was a result of him killing the servants he had sent out.
Yes.
So that act of rejection was a violent rejection, maybe foreshadowing the murder of Jesus and the prophets and others, you know,
yes,
which is part of what he says later. A to Z, they killed the prophets.
That's right. That's from Abel to Zechariah.
You hear the example given about in verse 12, where he talks about wedding clothes being sort of, you know, attire. And yet it seems like there's more of a spiritual application in this too.
Yes, I think so.
If you could do it in 30 seconds or less, is he talking about baptism? Is he just talking about a heart that's, you know, good soil?
All these things we've looked at, and where baptism we'll look at in 28. But you're right.
So we've seen the wheat and the tares, the fit, the net with the fishes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It may be from man's point of view, this fellow looked like he was compliant, but he wasn't,
right,
in the eyes of the king. And so there's an eventual sorting out, maybe.
I think that's right. So
there's an interesting parallel to the 11th chapter of Romans, where it speaks about the Jews being rejected and the Gentiles grafted in. But then he says, you Gentiles, better be careful. Because if the Jews were rejected, you couldn't be too. And that would be this man that didn't have a wedding garment.
I do think that's a warning to us. I've already asked that question. All right. Any other comment on this? Okay, so we'll go to the three questions. What was the question that the Pharisees and the Herodians asked Jesus in 22? Well, it's not 15:2, but 20, it starts at 15.
Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar?
Yeah, and it was not an honest question. They use this flattery for it to start with, and then they, to be honest, the Pharisees and the Herodians did not normally get along. The Herodians were followers of the Roman Empire, and the Pharisees thought that was the wrong thing. But because they disliked or hated Jesus so much, they made an alliance and came together ask him this question. The tax they were talking about was a census tax that started in AD 86 in Judea. Every inhabitant from age 12 to 65 had to pay it. And in AD 6, Judas of Galilee, that's in Acts 5:33, led a revolt against the payment. And so since that time, it was a heresy not to pay the tax to Caesar. So you see what they think they were trapping Jesus. If he said one thing, he'd get in trouble with Romans. If he said another thing, he'd get in trouble with the people. So what was the difficulty of this question? I think I just answered it. But if he said, yeah, you need to pay your taxes, and the people would say, I don't know about that. If he said, don't pay the taxes, he'd get in trouble with the Romans.
Like in the trial of Jesus, they accused him of saying, not to pay taxes.
Yeah, yes, you're right. So, his answer is just a marvelous answer. Asked for a coin. Said, whose inscription on it? Caesar's. He says, give to Caesar what Caesar's. And then he adds, unto God what is God's. And what did the Herodians and Pharisees do? They just walked away.
They ran out of questions.
It was just such a masterful answer on that question. Okay. The second question was asked by the Sadducees. Said, "Well, they failed, so we're going to come up and we're going to ask." What was the question that the Sadducees asked? Granted, these were all questions trying to trap them.
Well, now in the resurrection, what would the relationship be between man and wife, or two people who had been together but weren't?
Yeah. So, what do we know about the Sadducees?
They didn't believe in
them. They didn't believe in the resurrection, but here they were asking a question about that. They believed, sort of like, I think the Jehovah's Witness, when the soul dies, the body dies. Like Rover, when he died, he's dead all over. So, anyway. And they emphasized free will and accepted only the written law. In fact, they accepted only the book of Moses. So the answer of Jesus was masterful, because that's where he took it from. Did they use scripture? The Sadducees? Yeah, it was a scriptural and a question. It came from Deuteronomy 25:5-6, where if a man dies without children, his brother is to raise up children to his name. Genesis 38 is a story about a guy that didn't want to do it, and he was killed also for it. So it was a big thing. So what's the difficulty in this question?
You mean you mean the dilemma?
Dilemma, yeah. What is the dilemma here that Jesus had to answer?
Whose wife would she be when they were in the resurrection?
Yeah. So they made a mistake. What were the Sadducees mistaken about?
Well, they didn't understand the scriptures, and they didn't recognize the power of God either.
That's it. they were thinking that the heaven was going to be just like a continuation of earthly life. They just did not, and they were limiting the power of God to make it work.
So in the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, Paul said, well, how are the dead raised? He said, you're foolish if you think God doesn't have the ability to raise the dead and do whatever he wants to do.
Yeah.
So if we don't ever question the ability of God to do something, whether it will or not, we may have to determine, but he can do whatever he wants to do.
That's right. He can do it, he can get it around. So he condemns them for that, actually, he goes further. He uses scripture also in Exodus 3:6. Does anybody right off the top of their head know what that Exodus 3:6 is? I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He doesn't say, I was the God, I am the God. So that's what Jesus asked them. And they could, again, they couldn't answer the question. They just walk away in amazement. So the last shot, the Pharisees get together. They get a lawyer to ask what question?
What is the great commandment?
What is the greatest commandment? And Jesus answers from Deuteronomy 6:5. And to love God and then, but this is with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind. But he goes a little bit further. He says, and the second is to love your neighbor as yourself. The difficulty of this question, in my mind, is according to the rabbis, there were, in the law of Moses, there were 248 positive commands and 365 prohibitions. So which one of those was the greatest? Were they all important? Yes. But what Jesus used that 6:5 to answer?
Just occurred to me if somebody asked you that question right now, what's the greatest commandment? If you give any other answer than the one Jesus did, you're in trouble.
Yeah, I think so.
They're going to come up with something else that's just as bad or just as difficult.
So I can imagine, like the dilemma about the woman with all the various sibling husbands, you know, that you could look at all those and say, well, now what if it's the Sabbath and your ox falls in the ditch? So you could take a positive command and a negative command and bang them against each other. Say, well, then what are you going to do? You're going to have to violate one or the other. And I can imagine, and we do that sometimes too.
Yeah.
And somehow it's a way of discrediting the commands or something, or usually excusing disobedience, really.
Right.
You know, is it the loving thing to do? This is hard.
That's right.
You know,
yeah.
Withdraw from the person, then you've broken the relationship with them and you're not honoring your, you know what I mean?
Yep.
And we invent all these conflicts between God's commands. That kind of changes the coordinate system and say, no, don't think of it that way. Think about what do they all hang on? What is the heart of every one of them?
Yeah, in fact, he says this is all the prophets and the law. Why do you think he chose these two commandments? And I'll give you my answer. I think that the Ten Commandments are encapsulated by this command, these two commandments. The first four are about God, the second six are about somebody else. And I think that it shows that you start with God, and then everything else will fall into place. Any comments on it? Okay.
You know, that's really the basis. If we just get the right thing. Asked someone the other day about his conversion. Well, he said, I was in this church and his name was wrong. I came to the Church of Christ. Well, that's not really the question. The question is obeying God. Mm-hmm. And if this church has come closer to obeying God, okay. But it's a matter of obeying God and showing love for God rather than getting in the right church.
That's right. I said there's been members in conservative sound churches all over this country that are on directories that are probably not members of God's kingdom. I hate to say that, but that's just the way it is. So, we got to be careful to do what God tells us to do.
So I think you could use that teaching as a way of excusing a lot of disobedience. I think you've heard that. Well, you know, as long as you love God, these other things don't matter.
That's true.
You know, or, you know, so you can think of these hypothetical situations where you're going to have to disobey one command in order to obey the other. So you just ask the more general question, what's the loving thing to do for God or for men? But I think you can flip it over and say, no, I think it's actually the other way around. Loving God with all your heart and soul and mind, you're going to find every single possible way to get as close to what you think God wants you to do.
Yeah.
As opposed to using that kind of intent as an excuse for not
doing it. That's right.
Or disobeying.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think maybe that's a better way to
look at it. Yeah, yeah. In fact, in the verses that we got to look at, he makes a point about the Pharisees leaving out the weightier matters of the Scripture. But he says, they should have done what they did, but they should have done this. So you're right. Yeah. All right. He exposes the Pharisees for what they were. Okay. We're going to look at these verses, and we've got about 2 minutes. And so what I'll do, I'll just put them all up here. Okay. So we can see that he's teaching, and he's teaching directly at the Pharisees. I mean, they tell you to observe what they tell you, but they don't want to do it themselves. They put heavy burdens on the shoulders of men, but they won't lift a finger to do it themselves. All the works but it's kind of interesting. He says, "Do what they tell you to do, but don't be like them." And that's interesting. It sounds like they were actually telling them the right things to do, but they weren't doing them themselves. This is interesting here. Anybody know what a phylactery is? It's a leather strap that was either put on the head, the arm, or on the waist, and had a pouch on it with Old Testament scriptures in it. Well, they were making it long. They were increasing the fringes on the border that also represent Old Testament scriptures so that they could be seen. And the next one is they wanted the greetings in the marketplace. They wanted to be called rabbi. They wanted the best seats at feasts. All these things are superficial and worldly. And Jesus told them, don't be called rabbi. Call no one a father on your earth. Does that sound familiar? Some group that calls their priest father. And neither be called masters, because there's only one master in heaven. So,
and that master is the same thing as doctor, really, in the Greek. It doesn't mean you don't talk about a doctrine in college or university or something, but in the church, a man has no business trying to elevate himself among other preachers or other Christians because I'm doctor somebody.
Yeah. I think that that's what it's getting to. There's no place for rank in the brotherhood. Everybody are brothers. You know, you can be an elder, but you have no more significance than anybody else's. So. All right. Thank you very much.